Stories from Sydney on All the Best.
During the Keating years, we were invited by the Labor Party to sing at a policy launch about multicultural Australia. And we're a bit conflicted by this because hardly any of us are Labor supporters. But we thought, well, you know, we could see that there was an election coming up, and it was in fact the election that Keating lost. And we thought, well, we support multiculturalism, so yeah, all right, we'll go and sing at this. We'll sing for the Labor Party. And I recall conducting the choir, and Paul Keating came in and walked past me. We sang on the inside of this event, and then after we had sung, all of the audience was invited to the foyer to have hors d'oeuvres and a glass of wine. There were these people outside banging on the doors and holding placards and protesting. And there were Timorese people protesting against the ALP's betrayal of Timor. And so I and another member of the choir were standing there watching this, and he nudged me and he said, "Miguel, do you feel uncomfortable about being here right now?" And I said, "Yes, Tom, I do. Why don't we rally the troops and find a way out?" So we did. We rallied all the choir and said, "We want to leave now," and got shown out a back door. And then we went around the building to the front and joined the Timorese banging on the door saying, "Let us in, let us in." Mind you, we were just knocking on the door. Anyway, we watched on the news, and if you were watching carefully, you would have seen the Solidarity Choir in the background of the event, the ALP event, inside the building, and you would have seen the Solidarity Choir on the outside.
It's Miguel Heatwell from the Solidarity Choir. More from them soon. Hello, you're on All the Best on FBI 94.5. Thanks to Amy Gibbs for the last 3 hours of radio. She'll be back again next week. A big thanks to Gina McKeon also, who brought you All the Best last week in my absence. My name is Eliza Silas, with you today until 11. Today, our stories from Sydney here on All the Best come to you around the theme of protest. We'll be exploring protest through song and theatre, revisiting Sydney's first Mardi Gras and the waterfront dispute of the late 90s.
All the Best. Stories from Sydney.
On FBI.
The Solidarity Choir was formed in 1989 to sing in support for a free South Africa. Since then, it has been singing about a range of issues at concerts at home and overseas. Jesse Cox went down to their rehearsals to chat with them about singing and protesting, and as he found out during the interview, the choir would burst into spontaneous song. This is Miguel Heatwell talking about another time that the choir sang for East Timor.
There was that time also on Timor when they were having the vote, and the Timorese community held a vigil, and we started singing some of our Timorese songs. And I missed this because I had my back to the audience conducting the choir. And apparently when we started singing, an electric effect went through the audience.
Some of the choir could not look at them because they would have been unable to continue, and most of them were in tears.
What were you singing? What was the song you were singing?
We were singing Kolele Mai.
Kolele Mai, Rade Kokodele, Kolele Mai.
What does that song mean?
That was a traditional East Timorese folk song that got new words given to it by a fretland leader called Francisco Borja da Costa. He was killed on the first day of the Indonesian invasion. But the lyrics were political and they were anti-colonial. They were directed against the Portuguese. His lyrics continued to be relevant for another 25 years or so.
1, 2, 3, 4, marching down the street. Rolling of the drums and the trampling of the feet.
I wonder if I could get us talking about where we fit into the world of protest so that we can be useful for Jesse's program. One little thing that I wanted to talk about a bit, some of you will remember because you went on the tour in 2001, we went to England and Ireland and Wales. Over there, we met lots and lots of choirs, so it was really interesting to go to the left-wing choir capital of the planet. What we found was that lots of them, and one in particular in Wales, stood out as being a really dedicated street choir, and that's what they call themselves, street choirs. That one in Wales had been going for about as long as we had, so they were nearly 20, and they sang twice a week in the street, handing out leaflets and collecting money for Palestine. They'd been to Palestine a couple of times. But that was where they did their work, their interface with the public and with politics, was getting out into the streets. And that really inspired quite a few of us. When we came back, we thought, yeah, well, let's do the same thing. And we managed to go busking in King Street about twice.
The music and the protest going together, I mean, the two things that I guess for me are the really strong ones are when we the African songs, because you get a sense when we sing those, they're such strong songs, and you get a sense of how music can keep people going in a struggle. And that to me is really moving, so I love singing those songs. And also the union songs, because we've been singing union songs during a period where unions were so under attack and working people were under attack and working conditions were under attack. And I'm a unionist, and so those are really meaningful to me too. When you do have your back against the wall and we're being attacked constantly, it actually does help to sing those songs, because you get that sense of solidarity in the choir and you get that sense of being part of something bigger than yourself.
When we were in that rally where we marched down George Street a month or two ago, I think it really gave the whole demo some purpose, because they had something to focus around, because we were providing a noise, and whether or not they knew the tune was irrelevant, it had a melody, and there were sort of 25 people singing it.
They handed out all the words too.
Which I think was very useful in that situation.
What demonstration was that?
Was that the refugee one?
Refugees are welcome, close the detention centres. No visa freeze. I can rattle off those slogans because I'm looking at a poster on the wall here that we put up for it. It was on Saturday, the 26th of June at the Town Hall.
Miguel walked backwards down there.
Yeah, exactly. down
George
forward.
Street talking.
Yeah. Well, that's right.
Gonna keep on walking forward. Keep on walking forward. Keep on.
Did we make up a lyric for the refugees that day?
We did.
Gonna free the refugees.
Free the refugees.
No visa freeze. Free the refugees. Free the refugees.
Oh, very good. I wish I'd been there.
That was the Solidarity Choir, a Sydney-based community protest choir. They meet once a week in Newtown and are always looking for more members. If you want to get in touch or learn more, check out their website, solidaritychoir.com.au. Coming up soon, we chat with singer-songwriter Paul Spencer about his time in an anti-nuclear peace camp. You are on All the Best FBI 94.5 or FBIRadio.com. On today's show, we're exploring protest. We're doing it with our stories, of which there are more just around the corner, but we're also doing it through song. This next song comes from Brazil in the late 60s, where the cultural political movement of Tropicália emerged against the then right-wing government. It's by one of the movement's most well-known acts, Os Mutantes, and it's called Bat Macumba.
Got quite a slow, sad-ish sort of song about East Gippsland. Right. I'm Paul Spencer. I'm a folky. I don't know, that's probably enough. I didn't specially write songs to be a form of protest. I like the whole
idea of putting political ideas into songs and having that form of expression. And I think a lot of my songs are about expressing the experience of being part of the political movement.
Tomorrow, when all the bush is grey, the darkness before the break of day.
When I was a student in Sydney, we would go down to East Gippsland sometimes on in the holidays, and a lot of it was about being in a position to be arrested and then go away again and come back for the court case. And so we filled that role of being able to turn up and just get arrested the next day. So I wasn't one of the stalwarts that did all the actual solid campaigning work, but I did turn up and chuck myself in the front line when it was necessary. There were some wins, but there was a lot of losses in that campaign as well.
Remember when democracy meant freedom? It used to mean equality and liberty, and even things like peace and love and sharing were implied.
I've got family in Yorkshire, and we went over and sang in London and then toured around up north and over to Ireland and Wales and Scotland, and then I stayed in the UK and looked around and found out what kind of protesting stuff was going on, and lived at a peace camp opposite a nuclear weapons base for 6 months. It was in Scotland, and a lot of people in England weren't even really aware that Britain keeps nuclear submarines and nuclear warheads at this base just outside of Glasgow. I was at another protest site. It wasn't an active site at the time. People were just camping there waiting for the eviction to come and the action to start. And I said, is there anything else going on? And they said, oh, there's Faz Lane, that's this peace camp. And they said, oh, you wouldn't like it there. You can't smoke around the fire pit and you can't drink in the communal areas and stuff. And I went, oh, maybe I would like it there. So I went up there and tried that out. People do smoke and drink, but it was a much more kind of contained, we've got work to do sort of culture. It was a good sort of outdoor lifestyle on the edge of this small town full of people who mainly work at a nuclear weapons naval base. There's quite a lot of good local support as well for the camp, and it signified a whole lot of general opposition to nuclear weapons, not just we want to close down this base. It's still going. It's been there for, it would have been there then for 20 years, and it's still there.
How many roads must the man walk on before you go?
When I first got there, it was winter, so a lot of chopping wood and starting a fire and that kind of thing. It was quite well set up by the time I got there. There was a wood stove and a little, not quite a house, but a little kind of shack that they had the kitchen and lounge room in it. All kinds of different things would go on. Sometimes we'd get word that there was a convoy of nuclear warheads coming up from England, and so we'd go and stop them on the road and lock onto the trucks and climb on top of the trucks and stuff like that. Over the years, the security at the base had been stepped up and up. When the camp first got there, there was like a 7-foot tennis court fence around the outside, maybe a strand of barbed wire or something. And over the years, it got increased until when I was there, there was a 8-foot weld mesh fence with 3 rolls of razor wire on the top, and cameras and armed guards with dogs and motion sensors, and another roll of razor wire just inside the fence in case anyone did get over the fence. But the motion sensors were these tight wires that ran along the top of the fence, and so if you got a stick on a string and hooked it in the wires and pulled them, it would trigger the alarm, and this voice, this speaker would come on saying, "Bandits in the base! Bandits in the base!" which everyone quite liked. And as soon as that went off, all the squaddies had to go and line up somewhere and have this big security procedure, so they all hated it when that happened. Sometimes people would just go and trigger the alarm for no reason, but then the next day somebody would throw fireworks into the peace camp as they went past, so there was a bit of give and take when that kind of stuff went on. But also people would do serious actions, cutting a hole in the fence and getting through and seeing if someone can get down to one of the submarines. It's a while since anyone got onto a submarine, but people did get onto a boat that was full of computer equipment that was going to be used in the arming and deployment of the weapons on one of the submarines, and they threw all the computers overboard into the loch and got acquitted for it as well, actually, which was good. The most successful ones have been coming in by water. There hasn't been anyone get there through the fence for a long time, but it's still worth a try.
was Paul Spencer, who popped into the studio earlier this week to chat to All the Best, the program you're listening to right now on FBI 94.5. For more information on Paul's music, check out his website, paulspencer.org.
This land is mine, all the way to the old fence line. Every break of day, I'm working hard just to make it pay. This land is mine, yeah, I signed on the dotted line. Campfires on creek bed, bank breathing down my neck. They won't take it away. They won't take it away. They won't take it away from me.
You are listening to FBI 94.5. We're exploring protest today on the program. We did just hear from Kev Carmody, the author of many of Australia's greatest protest songs. The one we did just hear was This Land Is Mine.
Stories from Sydney
on All the Best.
Verbatim theatre is a form of storytelling using the real voices of communities to create the script and performance. In this next story, we chat to Sydney playwright and academic Paul Brown about his work on a project about Maralinga, the nuclear test site in the South Australian desert.
So, of course, I guess I'm going to be reading three or four different parts.
I'm Paul Brown. I work at the University of New South Wales, and I'm currently head of school for history and philosophy. And part of my outputs as an academic includes writing plays and film scripts. So that's how I come to remain involved in verbatim theatre, which is one of the strands of writing that I've been doing since I first got involved in student theatre back in the 1970s. In the 1980s, the community theatre movement in Australia really came of age. And there were a number of key companies around Australia. New technologies became available in the 20th century. It became possible to do exactly what we're doing now, to sit with a microphone and a relatively small tape recorder that's easily transported, and to interview anyone in a way which would provide a reasonably high-quality recording. In a way, verbatim theatre is a response to that change in technology. At the same time, it's always had a particular underlying purpose as a form of theatre which gives voice to people who don't normally get their voices heard. So it's always had that, I suppose, radical and protest side to it, that it's trying to tell a people's history. I call it a voice print because someone's voice print is like a fingerprint. It's unique to each person, and so one thing verbatim tries to do is preserve all the idiosyncrasies of a person's speech. The writer in a community context is most often an outsider, arriving with particular expertise and particular views of the world and meeting a community that has its life world, if you like. And so the first step is the bridging between the view of the outsider and the community context. What's completely different about the Maralinga project when I compare it to most other verbatim projects I've been involved with? Yes, there is a community, but it's a very dispersed community because those veterans, they went back to their individual military bases and back into civilian life, and they never really connected much. The stories that the veterans were telling us, They were stories that were full of the most vivid description of what it's like to stand in the path of a bomb blast and experience the sight of the mushroom cloud and then the feeling of the wind coming across the desert, which sometimes knocked people over. These are very vivid recollections. And then very sad stories of coping with ill health. So that incredible distinction between experiencing a bomb and holding it in awe, and then the after effects 50 years later, that your health is really crumbling away because you were there at the test. Okay, so the third piece is a scene called Death. And in this case, this is the story told by Kay about her husband's death from cancer caused by his exposure to radiation. He started to get this thickness in the throat and not being able to swallow. It used to all come out the stoma tube and then it would back up and come out the nose. It was terrible, poor bugger. And he couldn't, do anything. He couldn't get it down. The military was very interested in the response of troops in an atomic bomb blast. They wanted to know how quickly troops in the field could regroup and take action after they'd been hit by a nuclear blast. So a lot of the studies at Maralinga are not quite what you expect. They were not only testing bombs to see whether they were effective as bombs. They were testing things like whether a vehicle would be destroyed or not if it was close to the bomb, and whether a man could see the bomb blast, experience that horrible effect of a nuclear bomb, and have the wherewithal to run across, jump in the vehicle and drive on. It's also clear that there were some informal experiments going on which the men weren't really told about, and that was, if you were a driver and your job was to go out and collect the carcasses of the goats, you weren't necessarily told that you were part of an experiment, but certainly observations were taken of how men did those tasks. So there was a combination of men who were trained to stand close to the bomb and knew that's what they were doing, and others whose daily life was being observed, who were not explicitly told that they were part of an experiment. For the funeral, we had given him the photo of all the family, and they had that on the pillow lying beside him with the carnation. His tongue had gone back, and his face had, all the puffiness had gone. There were no lines on his face. It was like as he was reborn sort of thing, and all those red marks and everything, yes, they'd all gone. And the RSL put the flag on the coffin. I was born in that year where atomic tests started in Australia. So I do feel that the Maralinga Project is something that's about my whole life. There's, I think, a strong sense if you're working on nuclear issues that you're picking a point in time in an issue that's timeless. In a way, writing about nuclear issues has now become an act of writing about the future. It's about where we try to head by making decisions now, knowing that many of the decisions have already been made for us. It's too late. You can't undo Hiroshima or Maralinga. As the hour approached for the atomic burst, the budgerigars, they all settled in the trees and went completely silent. 10 seconds before detonation, we would turn our backs. They said, put your hands in to make a fist and press them into your eyes. That was too uncomfortable. They all faced the audience with their hands pushed into their eye sockets, slightly bent in a submissive pose. 3, 2, 1.
That was Paul Brown. reading from the latest draft of Maralinga. Keep an ear out for information about the progress of that play. Paul is also editing a book on verbatim theatre soon to be released through Currency Press and launched this October. You are listening to All the Best, where today we are exploring protest. Coming up soon, we head down to the wharves in the late 90s to relive one of Australia's most severe and protracted industrial relations disputes. Right now, though, we're going to jump around the other side of the world with Nina and 99 Luft Balloons. This song, would you believe, was a song in protest against the Berlin Wall. The best
stories from Sydney
on FBI.
Sean Chaffer's my name, and I worked for the Maritime Union of Australia as an official for a number of years, but I kicked off life in the seagoing industry at 16 years of age, and went away to sea as a deck boy, as they were called then, and embarked on a career, if you like, or took on the job of union organiser with the Maritime Union for a while. So that's where my involvement with Patrick Stevedore's dispute came about. The union and the company were trying to negotiate an enterprise agreement, but overriding all of that, you had a new Liberal government in place that was looking to dismantle the Maritime Union and unions per se, and they backed the company, as it turned out, in a conspiracy which they, you know, they ran the companies broke, and they, of course, they, on the 7th of April, they sent in the balaclavas, the dogs, and the faceless people to evict our membership off the waterfront there, right around the country. One of my great friends from the picket line in 98, and we've been very close ever since, was at work at Darling Harbour, and he was in his machine. And he's a pretty fit, strapping sort of a bloke, and a young bloke, and then next minute there was this big, larger bloke knocking on the forklift and saying, mate, you haven't got a job anymore, and get out of the gate. So you can imagine in the middle of the night, they didn't know who these were, and the way that they did it was just atrocious. And that's what led to such wonderful community support of the Maritime Union in that dispute. In a nutshell, the public support was fantastic and really carried the day for us. People just said, look, you don't do that in Australia. You don't go into a workforce with your balaclavas and your big dogs and your batons and you tell people they're out of a job. And it was pretty much black and white along those lines, if you like, you know. There's just, it wasn't Australian to use that term, and people just said, we're not going to cop it. And what can we do to help you? My role was, as I indicated, I worked for the Maritime Union of Australia, and we had peaceful assemblies, and we set up camp, if you like, outside all of the gates around Australia where Patrick had their workforce. I was assigned to Darling Harbour. There were three officials assigned down there, and on a rotating basis, we'd do a 12-hour shift to ensure that things were being carried out in the fashion which needed to be. Pretty much the whole time of the dispute, I was down in and around Darling Harbour. Around the country, people said, this isn't going to happen on our watch, and we're going to vote with our feet. We're going to stand outside the gates of Patrick, and if there is the need, we'll lock arms, we'll interlock bodies, and we'll put a human barricade to ensure that the operation that they were trying to get going wasn't going to happen. There was a lot of desperation out there, I think. People that had worked on the waterfront for years, not only, but some second and third generation of waterfront labour, and they've got to pay their mortgages. Most people haven't got a slush fund which they can go to in times of this. We tend to live week to week, pay packet to pay packet, and there was a hell of an amount of concern out there. Even as new employees come onto the waterfront, there was a bit of concern that maybe, you know, were they behind the gates during the dispute? You know, are they coming to work here now? But essentially, the workforce have got to be commended in the spirit that they held themselves and they went back to work and got on with work. Because having gone back through the gates, and that was just a marvellous experience when we marched back through the gates, we were never supposed to go back in. Union members weren't supposed to be working on the waterfront.
That was Sean Schaefer of the Maritime Union, remembering the Patrick's Waterfront dispute in 1998. You are listening to All the Best here on FBI 94.5. We're exploring protest on today's program, and we'll continue doing that throughout, the next 20 minutes of the show. Also in this next song, a bit of a language warning on it. It does come to us from the herd. It's called 77. Here on FBI 94.5.
77% of Australians agree with John Howard's actions on the Tampa.
What happened to the others?
The thing is to use military force against refugees. Isn't that a little overkill?
A spokesman for the line that owns the ship says Australian SAS troops are in danger of breaking the laws of piracy.
Undoubtedly, this is the most popular decision as far as the Australian public are concerned the government's made during its reign.
The captain, before entering Australian waters, yet sent out a distress signal.
Clearly, our solution was, it wasn't any farcical, it was immoral.
I wish that this problem were not ours.
Sitting here, staring into a beer, shaking my head at the same old loathing and fear. Stranger in my own land, can't understand how the very word Australian has just been damned. I fucking hate myself, take Aussie from my name, erase this endless shame, forever cast some blame. If you don't act the same, will I destroy you? Everyone looks the same, beaten black and blue. So I've had enough of these redneck pricks, when fact is the only real shit that sticks. Watch as I tear the very skin from my face, so none will see my race, my deep disgrace. You're not even from here in the first place. And those who are, you want a further debate? Nah, no more, never again. Whether by fist or pen, I will defend, cause I'm at a loose end. The shattered remnants of Aussie dignity, I'ma skip whitey round eye, surprise me. Use your shrivel brain to please explain how the clever country just went down the drain. We rode the sheep's back, now the sheep ride you. If this is how it's gonna be, don't call me True Blue. I denounce my ancestors, wounds still fester. If you say that, so I suggest you wake up. Wake up, this country needs a fucking shake up. Wake up, these cunts need a shake up. Wake up, this country needs a fucking shake up. Wake up, these cunts need a shake up. Wake up, this country needs a fucking shake up. Wake up, these cunts need a shake up. Wake up, this country needs a fucking shake up. Wake up. Talk back, squawking hacks, won't relax until Jonesy's a manic and laws are all axed. 77% of Aussies are racist. If you're here, I'll say it to your faces. Rich redneck pricks still hold all the aces. I'll buy you a beer with an arsenic chaser. Better off dead, is that what I've said? Tempting to take for all the blood you've shed. No doubt you're as bad as your dads and your mums. Mainstream media making me so fucking glum. Anglo reality, intellectual cavity, Channel 9 fostering prejudice mentalities. I won't be a casualty, just mention casually. I can't stand for your shit-eating bullies, preying on peeps without a mainstream voice. Most of you stay silent, but I got no choice. Wake up, this country needs a fucking shake up. Wake up, these cunts need a shake up. Wake up, this country needs a fucking shake up. Wake up, these cunts need a shake up. Wake up, this country needs a fucking shake up. Wake up, these cunts need a shake up. Wake up, this country needs a fucking shake up. Wake up. Well, I've yelled my lungs out, but to no avail. Well, I've yelled my lungs out, but to no avail. Well, I've yelled my lungs out, but to no fucking avail. That you're a stranger yourself. Now that's the sting in the tail. Captain Cook was the very first Q jumper. It was immigrant labour that made Australia plumper. Enough is enough. Whiteys, go pack your stuff. Don't wanna live in England? That's fucking tough. I'm sick and tired of this redneck wonderland. Most you stay silent and I can't understand. I just can't understand. It's time for you to wake up. This country needs a fucking shake up. Wake up. These cunts need a shake up. Wake up. This country needs a fucking shake up. Wake up. These cunts need a shake up. Wake up. This country needs a fucking shake up. Wake up. These cunts need a shake up. Wake up. This country needs a fucking shake up. Wake up.
The Herd off An Elephant Never Forgets. Track we just heard was 77%. You're listening to FBI 94.5. We're exploring the theme of protest. We have been throughout all of today's show and will continue to. Kate Jinks is, of course, up after 11 with Too Much, talking about the talkies here on FBI 94.5.
Stories from Sydney. This is All the Best on FBI.
On the 24th of June in 1978, a nighttime celebration occurred following a morning protest march in commemoration of the Stonewall riots. And so was the first ever Mardi Gras. The first 10 minutes were bursting with elation, pride, and a great sense of freedom. When Peter Murphy set out to walk the streets in celebration of love, and who should have it, he could not have known what he was about to walk into.
We went through Darlinghurst Road up to the Alamein Fountain. All the people in King's Cross thought it was fantastic. All these costume people chanting and carrying on in the street was quite novel. And, you know, it just added to the zest of King's Cross. It was pretty late at night. I'd say it was around 11 to 11.30 at night by the time we were there. But when we got to the Alamein Fountain, we realised, you know, it was a very dangerous situation. And we only had one megaphone or something. So it was hard to even coordinate such a big group of people. But we stopped at the fountain and we were very close to the police station. And we said with the megaphone that, you know, how dangerous it seemed to be. The best thing to do was to leave the whole area together, and that we would walk back down Darlinghurst Road. And when we got to the top of the cross, we would then disperse. It was pretty quiet by then. There wasn't any chanting. We just walked back. You know, I think we were linked arms. I think we turned into the straight of the Darlinghurst Road, and the police vehicles came straight at us with their lights on high beam. And in all of the side streets, there were police vehicles. We walked past the side street and see, oh my God, you know, what's going to happen? I just saw these people being bashed and knocked down and dragged by the police. So I think, you know, I had friends on either side of me, and we all just said, well, let's go, you know. And we just ran straight at the situation where the cops were bashing people and grabbed people and dragged them away. But unfortunately, there were so many cops. I mean, I just got grabbed myself straight away and swung. I'm such a small person. They just swung me through the air and I landed next to a police paddy wagon, and I was thrown into a paddy wagon. And that was within a minute or two of the whole thing starting. I remember watching the situation through the windows of the paddy wagon, and it was chaotic, you know. People, I think, on the first floor balconies of the buildings on Darlinghurst Road were throwing things at the police. And our people were picking up rubbish bins or whatever was on the street and hurling it back at the police, and there were fist fights on the street. So there was all these sort of melees happening all around under those lights in Darlinghurst Road, and I thought, my gosh, you know, it's really a riot now. They opened the door again, and out I went, and I remember my glasses fell off or something like that, and I had to bend down, I had to stop to pick them up. And when I stood up, a policeman whacked me straight in between the eyes with his fist, and I was sort of knocked a bit stunned, you know. And then I was bundled back in. Anyway, they got us to the police station, and that's when the things got a bit worse for me. So this really big cop opens the back door, and he says, you know, you and you out, and you stay. You know, that was me. They went and got me, and they rushed me through the whole police station. You know, it was a bit of a maze. And anyway, they threw me into a room that seemed to be have a fair bit of sort of gymnastic equipment in it, or maybe a junk room. I can't recall very well, because they started whacking me straight away. So it was an awful beating I received. and I'm pretty sure it's just the one policeman, the really big guy, and he was really screaming. His face was so distorted, you know, at me, cursing me, saying, you know, I wasn't so smart now and stuff like that. But he beat me so much around the head and body, and then knocked me to the ground and tried to break my leg. And by that, I was sort of convulsing. But the other cop said, "That's enough," you know, and he did stop. Anyway, somehow or other, word got out that I'd been injured, and eventually the cops came and got me from there and took me to another room in the police station, which I was very frightened what was going to happen then. But in there was a doctor and a lawyer. I knew the doctor well, and they had managed to convince the cops that I should be at least, you know, given an inspection and checked me over, and the lawyer listened to my story, and the police officer watching me was like a superintendent. He had his full uniform on with lots of brass on the top. And the doctor said, well, he should just go straight to hospital. And the cops just said, no, take him back to the dock. That's the sort of crap that went on then, you know. That Monday I had to appear at Central Court, you know, the Magistrates Court. I could barely walk. So if the Saturday night was a horror, you know, the Monday morning was another horror. There was, I don't know, 100 cops at least at the front of the court, and then they blocked the door. So it was a really chaotic scene. We got to the top of the stairs and the cops said, "We're not letting anyone in." And we said, you know, "We're supposed to appear," and then this guy whacked me in the face, you know, like I got punched in the face by a cop. You know, we were reeling back, and then the cops got stuck into all the people at the bottom of the stairs, so another 15 people were arrested then, you know. Eventually we got into the court, and a couple of people stood up and said they pleaded guilty, but most people pleaded not guilty. And then when my name got called, I had this solicitor with me, and he said, "We'd like to see the arresting officer, otherwise we're not pleading anything." And the arresting officers weren't there, so we didn't plead, and they got put back to mention, I think, on the Thursday, and they didn't show. And on the Friday, they finally showed. We got their names, and then we went and laid an assault charge against the two police officers. Overall, what happened after that was the sort of community regrouped, and eventually we got the charges dropped, but it took about another year. There was a lot of other things that police were doing against the Labor government in 1978. There was an election going to be that year. So, you know, the gay movement was a sort of a target of opportunity. Time in the next year, 1979, that a letter went out to people saying that the charges against you have been abandoned or, you know, dismissed or withdrawn. But I got a letter saying, "The charges against the 53 have been withdrawn, except in your case," because I had charged the police with assault, you see. So I had to go to court and be processed in the court. I got found guilty on 3 counts. I was found guilty of participating in an illegal procession and hindering police and resisting police. They made it all up. Anyway, the magistrate didn't listen, and in the circumstances, the other people who could have been my witnesses all failed to attend, and it was mainly because of intimidation. We decided to appeal. That took me till 1981. I got off the illegal procession charge, but I was still found guilty of the other two and fined, you know, a couple of $100 and stuff like that. That cleared the way for my charge against the police to be then heard. They set a date for the hearing when I was at sea, and when my solicitor asked for a different date, they refused. So I didn't attend, and therefore the case was dismissed.
Do you think that you ever will receive that apology? Do you think that day will ever come?
You never know your luck. You never know your luck.
But then I spent so many nights thinking how you did me wrong, and I grew strong, and I learned how to get along. And so you're back from out of space. I just walked in to find you here with that sad look upon your face. I should have changed that stupid.
That was Annalise Todd with Peter Murphy, who is one of the original 78ers from the first Mardi Gras 32 years ago. That's all for today's show. Thanks so much for listening. If you want to hear more of the program, we do podcasts. They're all kept at fbiradio.com. Thank you today to all our guests, to our contributors, Annalise Todd, Bridie Moran, Michelle Freeman, and today's producer, Jesse Cox. Thanks, as always, to our EP, Bridget Dagg. Next week, it's all about you. Well, the different types of you. According to psychologist Carl Jung, there are 8 basic personality patterns or archetypes which all of us will live through or identify with in the course of our lives. On All the Best next week, we put our own spin on Jung's archetypes and get acquainted with 8 unique Sydney-siders, each of their stories reflecting one of Jung's archetypes: the hero, the mother, the trickster, the child, the wise man, the mentor, the scarecrow, and, of course, the devil. Amongst them, Sydney's most notorious occultist, a lawyer with a somewhat unlawful past, and, could it be, Superman himself. Tune in next Saturday to meet them all, and with the help of guest psychologist David Russell, find out which archetype might be influencing your life. Kate Jinks is, of course, up next with Too Much. We'll leave you now with a track from one of the strongest periods of protest in recent musical history, taking do-it-yourself idealism and progressive politics to create a new form of protest music. From the Riot Girl movement of the 1990s, this is Bikini Kill with Suck My Left One. Kate Jinks is up next with Too Much.
Suck My Left One, take one. Let's roll.
All the best
stories from Sydney
on FBI.